Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends at Safer Roads GM, helping us to keep ourselves and each other safe on the road to Manchester. This week, I'm joined by legendary music executive and founder of Creation Records, Alan McGee. Alan talks about meeting Noel Gallagher and signing Oasis to Creation Records at King Tut's in Glasgow.
And I walk on in, and in Man City Blue with Adidas, the main man, he's sitting there, Liam Gallagher. Yeah. And I was like, didn't know it was Liam Gallagher, obviously, at this time, but I just thought, Manx in the area.
And he talks about his love for Manchester.
I thought it was an unlucky city for me, and then I ran into Oasis. I feel more at home, this sounds mad, but I feel more at home in Manchester than I do in Glasgow these days.
Gives a great pleasure to welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester a chap who has been responsible for bringing us some of the most monumental British music of all time, mainly through his work with Creation Records, and without his vision, bands like Jesus and Mary Chain and the Primal Scream, Oasis, we might never have heard that music. His name's Alan McGee, and it's a pleasure to see you again, man. How are you?
All right, Clint.
Good to see you.
Yeah, man.
You're looking good.
I've got the jumper on that we could to stop myself coughing through your show.
Yeah, you were saying you're feeling...
I've had that spluttering bug.
A bit under the weather.
I'm all right. I mean, I don't think I'm contagious. I think you're all right.
Right, I'll be all right. I seem to have a good immune system these days. I don't know why, after all we've been through. But yeah, I'm still standing here. It's great to see you. We're going to be chatting about, obviously, the amazing career you've had. Your love affair with Manchester, obviously. You lived here for a period of your life. First of all, let's talk about the beginning. Where and when were you born, Alan?
Govan Hill, Clint, in Glasgow, which... South side of Glasgow, I mean, it's kind of went a wee bit downhill in recent times, you know what I mean? But it was all right when I was there. And then I moved up when I was five, Clint, to Mount Florida. I started going to Mount Florida Primary School. That's where I started meeting most of Primal Scream.
Right, is that still a suburb of Glasgow then?
Yeah. That's just down for Govan Hill. And then I went up to King's Park School and I met Bobby Gillespie, moved for Springburn. All the members of the band went to that school.
Amazing.
And we all knew each other when we were 10, 11, 12, do you know what I mean? And then we were all like into football, and then it got to about we got to about 15, punk happened, me and Gillespie really got into it, and it was really the beginning of the Primal Scream creation thing.
And everything else that came with it as well. It's like the amount of people we've talked on these podcasts where punk was the Damascus moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And each of these people, what's come from that, the shotgun effect of everything you've created since punk, and the same with Anthony Wilson, and, you know, it's just amazing. I don't think the man in the street always understands the significance of the punk movement. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So you're born in September 1960.
Yeah.
So you're a few months younger than me. So I can relate to a lot of these moments in your life, and I can relate to a lot of the people we're going to talk about because I know them, because they're mates.
Yeah.
But what sort of childhood was it up in Glasgow then? Was it working class?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like my mum was a shop assistant. My dad was a panel beater. And, you know, it was as real as you wanted to get, you know what I mean? You know, they always had jobs, though, too. I mean, it was never, we were never completely on our arse, but we never had any money, do you know what I mean? I remember when I got to 11, Killen asked my mum and dad for pocket money, and my old man went, go and get a job.
Yeah.
I went, all right. And I went and got a paper round, and, it wasn't even a paper round, it was distributing this free paper, Southside News.
Yeah.
It was 10 pence, but you could get it, and I used to knock 200 papers out every day and make a bit of money for myself. You know?
It's funny when you say about that period, that in the 60s, if you're out of work, back then there was a stigma with it. In working class,
definitely.
My mum and dad were always working, and it's like if somebody got divorced, it was unheard of, wasn't it? It was massive. Yeah. Our times have changed. You didn't do very well at school, did you?
Rubbish.
Is it one O level or one?
One O level, yeah. I don't know if I tried or I was just rubbish. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, did I try? I'm not sure.
I think the word is, some of us were distracted.
I never got school because the teachers were bullies, man, you know what I mean? And they were just like horrible people, you know what I mean? And I was just like, you're just a bunch of idiots. I don't want to know about it. But I didn't really know. I had a dream, obviously, which was music, but I didn't really know if it would work out. I suppose the chances of music working out for me was about 1,000 to 1 or somewhere, you know what I mean? But it did work out for me, so it was good, you know.
Same here, because in the 1960s, early 1970s, the people that we saw on TV, on Top of the Pops, or making records in general, were all brilliant musicians. You couldn't blag it. You couldn't blag it being a shit bass player. You had to be a good musician back then. So I never, even though I dreamed of being a pop star, it's like I never thought I was going to be a good enough musician to do it, really. But I dreamed of it. And if anybody said, "What do you want to do? I want to be Elvis." You know what I mean?
You were good though. You could keep up.
I got there, but I blagged it. If punk hadn't have happened, I wouldn't have been able to be a successful keyboard player, it's just everybody's standards came down a bit, didn't they? You know what I mean? So it's like,
I liked it as a bass player. I was all right, but I wasn't a natural musician. You know what I mean? You know, I knew at a certain point, but I knew by the time I got to about 21 that I was like a chancer. You know what I mean? You know, I'd started managing my own little band, and I'd kind of went, I think I'm actually quite good at that.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of fell into that. You know what I mean?
Just backtrack to before punk came along, what was the music that was the most attractive to you growing up through so the early 70s?
The glam thing, which is T-Rex was my first band, then it was Slade, and then I found David Bowie, and then I was like, I was in, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I was into all that. Shwadu Adu as well, was one of mine. Shwadu Adu.
But it was the punk thing, it missed Glasgow quite a lot. It didn't miss Glasgow with people like me and Bobby and Jim Kerr, people like that, Charlie Burchill. It got all us. But the real truth was that Glasgow City Council had banned punk bands, and so you had to go to Edinburgh or Paisley to see punk bands. So, in a way, Glasgow never produced any punk bands until it was Simple Minds were a band called Johnny and Self Abusers at the time, and I auditioned for Simple Minds because I knew Charlie Burchill. I mean, it was rubbish, you know. I mean, I think I auditioned to be the rhythm guitar player and they're about to become Simple Minds, do you know what I mean? You know? Didn't get the job, you know, but I'm sort of friends with them, you know what I mean?
What were the key moments then in the punk, when punk happened, what were the key moments to you?
I think the Clash coming to Glasgow.
Yeah.
That was a big moment. I mean, the Clash were a bigger deal in Glasgow than the Sex Pistols, actually.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which nobody really talks about, but that, because the Sex Pistols couldn't come to Glasgow because it was like, I think they came to Edinburgh in 76. And they never came back to Scotland. And the Clash used to come every 6 months. So they kind of felt like our band. And that's why you get all these Scottish old punk rockers like me and Bobby Gillespie and, like, you know, Jim Kerr all rattling on about, you know, the Clash.
Yeah, the Clash. They were significant, weren't they? Massive. And I saw them on the Anarchy tour. So when, like you said, the Sex Pistols got banned from every town in the country after the Bill Grundy TV thing, but Manchester was one of only probably two places that would put them on. So they came here in December of 76.
Yeah.
Did the Electric Circus, which is where I saw them.
Did you see Pistols then?
Yeah. December the 9th, 1976.
Amazing.
At the Electric Circus. So it was a few months after the Free Trade All gig that they did. The lineup was Buzzcocks, Johnny Thunders, The Clash, and The Sex Pistols for £1.20.
Genius.
And it's just like, just the best £1.20 any man has ever spent, because it just completely. I didn't do very well at school. I went to an all boys grammar school.
Right.
And it was like, say, getting bullied by these adults that like whipping kids, you know what I mean?
It wasn't the pupils. The pupils were all right. They all got. It was the teachers. Yeah. It was like, the teachers were just neds. Yeah. Neds with suits.
Same here. So I could totally relate to that. So punk came along and completely made the world better for us all. Soon after that, you moved to London, didn't you? Is that right? About 80, 81, you moved to London?
No, 1980, June 1980. I was 19 and I was with Andrew Ennis in this wee band and called Newspeak. And we were changing the name to The Laughing Apple. And he went, "We're going to move to London and become pop stars, McGee."
Yeah.
As in me and him, nobody else. It was one other guy. He fell out of it and went home after about 2 or 3 weeks. But we're going to go to London and become pop stars. But if you don't come, you're out of the band. Yeah. And he taught me to play the bass. Like, I could play rudimentary bass like Paul Simon. And so I thought, this is my only shot. So I went to London. And it kind of, in the long term, it worked out. You know, Andrew ended up in Primal Scream because I put him in the band. And it worked out for me because I ended up being a manager. Do you know what I mean?
Did you have a proper job? Was it British Rail that you
worked
for?
Yeah, I got a job down there.
What did you do?
I had a job in Glasgow doing British Rail, but I was just a stores clerk.
Okay.
I think I'm going to be portrayed in the film that's coming out as a wee guy that ran about in a British Rail uniform. I don't have the heart to go on if I wore one. I'm just going to let it go. You
brilliant.
Know?
Was it Jar Wobble? I think he worked on the Underground as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Was he a cleaner, though?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, like, Wobble could be anything. You
brilliant.
Know what I mean? Security.
We're talking about the early 80s here. So it was beautiful, I thought, how punk. The 80s could have been tragic, couldn't it? If we hadn't have had punk to keep that underlying edge to the 80s, it would have been rubbish, but it turned into this beautiful, again, this transitional moment, didn't it, between punk and what was coming next.
Yeah.
Favourite bands, standout bands for me, people like the Wolfhounds,
yeah.
World Domination Enterprises, these bands, we've never seen anything like this, and it was just a beautiful time. What were your memories of your earliest memories of the 80s, before you set up your label, before you started... Well, Biff Bang Power before that.
I mean, I started pretty early. Nobody even knows this. I only really remembered it myself. The first three bands I ever tried to sign when I didn't even put a record out at this point were the Pogues, because I went to their second ever show.
Right.
Tried to sign them. And Shane McGowan, he was only a couple of years older than me, and he was looking at me like I was this wee innocent boy about 21 trying to sign this mental band, the Pogues. And he actually got a meeting. I went round to Shane's house and he'd a flat just off of some mad road in the King's Cross where the prostitutes used to hang around. You
know, I had to know that area, but I only know it because on my first trips to London, that's where we always used to stay in the bed and breakfast because it's so
what
cheap.
Was it called? Argyle Square or somewhere?
Yeah, it was right opposite King's Cross.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, all the prostitutes used to be there. He had a flat up the top. And I went in and Shane was obviously getting up to a lot of brown business, you know what I mean? It was like, all like... You know, and anyway, I think I got sent packing in a nice way because I just think he thought this wee boy's just a bit too innocent for this rubbish that I'm into. So I got sent away. The next band I tried to sign was a Prefab Sprout because I heard Lions of Moan Garden on John Peel. And at this point, Kitchenmere hadn't even come in and signed them. And I tried to sign them. I wrote them a letter. But I was always 21, cunt, you know what I mean? And then and then the other band I heard, and Rough Trade had already got it, but I heard Hand in Glove, and I tried to sign the Smiths. I sent them a letter as well. So I was a wee guy that just got in and done his thing. But eventually, as I grew up, I developed skills, and I managed to sign bands.
And it's funny, because that's what you're famous for, isn't it? Like, you're an household name through your work with Creation, Oasis, Primals, et cetera, but I think people often forget you did front your own band as well for several years. You did six albums, didn't you? Biff Bang Pow.
Yeah.
Six albums?
Yeah. But it was never an attempt to be famous or a pop star or anything like that. It was not like that, you know. We just put the records out, Clint, because we could, and you know, they were cheap. We were making albums for £500 and stuff like that, because it was, you could get 3 days in the studio and bang an album out. So we were just doing it, and we were okay, you know what I mean? You know, it was like, I don't think it was like a great band or anything, but I think it was a dodgy band. It was like we had a good laugh doing it.
Yeah, I think it was what was going on across Britain at the time. As I said, that the punk thing had changed everybody's standards and expectations, so you could get away with not being a brilliant musician.
Yeah, I agree.
And if the spirit on the record was right, people would buy it. Like the first Buzzcocks records were just like so cheap and scratchy. And
but the ideas with Buzzcocks were always better than the execution. The ideas were brilliant.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Creation Records, you started that in 1983. Was it the Jesus and Mary Chain that was your first signing? Or?
No. I put a rubbish record. The very first record I ever put out was a guy, he's my pal, guy called Jerry Thackeray. You know him as a legend.
That's right, the legend, yeah.
Good guy, really good guy. But I put his record out, terrible record.
Yeah.
And it taught me a big lesson because I actually thought it was a good record. And then, you know, and then it got slated by all the music papers. And then I suddenly realised, I've got to do better. And I took 6 months out, came back January 1984 and put Pastels, Jasmine Minx.
Yeah.
Route Revolving Paint Dream, which was Andrew, and Biff Bang Pow, which was me, and we got pretty good reviews. It started going the right way.
And the name Creation became synonymous with that new scene of great indie music, didn't it?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Jesus and Mary Chain, because I remember the impact that had on the scene when it started. I mean, it was making the tabloids way before Oasis did it.
Yeah.
Jesus and Mary Chain were like mates of yours, obviously, but
the
kind of violence, the sonic violence, and the physical violence in the venue had never been seen on a rock and roll stage, had it, at that point?
Well, the truth is that we got lucky. We had this club at the going, and it was funding the label called The Living Room. And I bumped into them, and I knew they were a great band. So immediately after one song at the sound check, they were about to kick off and punch each other, you know, the two Reed brothers. And I went, I'll be your manager. And amazingly, they went, all right. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, God, well, they really don't know what they're doing if they're making me the manager. That was what I really deep down thought, you know?
Yeah.
But and we started doing it, and it blew up really fast. This first single went out and sold 50,000 copies, which bloody good. And then we done this gig, which was kind of blew the whole band out of the water, at North London Polytechnic. And about 2 or 3 weeks before, the Canadian News Channel had said, we're going to film this gig because, you know, this band are happening and we want to film happening bands. And I had a TV crew there, and there was a riot. I got lucky, Clint, because I didn't know there was going to be a riot. Much to a lot of people's dismay, they think it's through an agent provocateurs to blow it up. I didn't, you know what I mean? I was like, but I made sure when it was kicking off that the people were like filming it. So, and then that way, like that footage go everywhere and you know, this band have riots at shows. Yeah. So every second gig for the next year was cancelled. But we always got paid, do you know what I mean? Because the gig was cancelled. So it was great for us.
I think I think it was a Manchester gig. I didn't actually go to it, but the reports were like, it lasted 8 minutes on stage.
Yeah.
And then the fight that started on the dance floor that spilled out into the street lasted about an hour. Jesus emerged. Thankfully, they've mellowed now, aren't they, the Reed brothers?
Yeah, that was a gig at the Hacienda. That was a good story to that one, though. You like this one? It was like, our mutual friend Mike Pickering booked it. He was in Quango Quango.
That's right.
Do you remember that? So I show up. I think I'm Malcolm McLaren at the time, right?
Yeah.
So I show up at the Hacienda. I've sold 800 tickets, so I'm filling myself, right? And I show up and I go, all right, Mike. And he goes, all right, Al. He goes, what are you doing here? And I went, we're doing a gig tonight. No, wrong night. And I went, right night. And he went, no, wrong night. And I got my contract out and I went, right night. He'd put posters up around the town. He'd sold it for the wrong night. Do you know what I mean? But the contract was, we're playing here. And the next night we were in Nottingham, so I couldn't even help him out. And this is the power of radio at the time. He put it out on, it must have been BBC Manchester or like the local radio station. I don't know what it would be. We got all the 800 people to come to the show, even though he'd advertised the gig the wrong night.
Yeah. Were you inspired by Malcolm McLaren?
In the beginning, I thought I was Malcolm McLaren for quite a long time. I was totally inspired by him.
You did really well with that.
But as you get older, you know what I mean? You know, you become your own thing. You know,
absolutely,
in the 90s, I was my own thing.
Well, you've ended up in a different place at your age than McLaren was at your age. Yeah. He was very extravagant and flamboyant. Yeah, you've always been quite humble. Right. What about Tony Wilson? Did you get to know Tony pretty well, didn't you?
Really well, yeah. I love Tony Wilson.
And again, very, very similar maverick sort of characters.
Yeah. Are the people that I would look up to in the music business, it's not the standard people. It's Luke Oldham, Malcolm, Tony, Seymour Stein. That's the people that I kind of like have any empathy with, because most of the people I don't get them. You know what I mean? You know?
All characters that sort of go against the grain a bit and not scared to shake things up a bit.
Yeah.
Before we talk about Oasis, let's talk about the time where you lived in Manchester a bit, didn't you? Daft question. What brought you here?
Well, I mean, if it, you want me to be really honest, the drugs. You know what I mean? You know,
it's right, like, answer,
it was
like,
it's right, I, like, I went into this guy's house one day, because I'd just discovered ecstasy in Brighton, and I'd got Bobby Gillespie on it. Well, Sean had got Bobby Gillespie on when Sean popped a pill in Bobby's mouth, and Primal Scream went acid house. That actually happened. So I was pals with the Mondays. Yeah. I was big pals with Tony. And then I'd been up for a weekend. I was hanging out with Debbie Turner. Yeah. And I was like, do you know what? I'm going to move here. Probably coming down off an E. And she took me around to some big nameless guy. I can't say the name because he's probably a straight guy now with a family. Yeah. I went to this big individual's house and he opened the fridge. It was about 1,000 or maybe more, maybe 5,000. But it was a fridge full of E's. And I thought, I'm coming. Because we found it hard to get them in Brighton, and I thought I can work for here, and come down to London during the week, but I can live between the two places. Yeah. So I did for about a year,
and we were all very impressed that you come living with us. We thought that was because there's always been a real like connection between Glasgow and Manchester, and you coming living here was exactly that. It's like McGee's living here. Why is he living here? Why is he living here? But yeah, it was great.
Do you know one of the times I saw you? I mean, I used to see you all over the place. Right? You remember you used to have that black and white jacket, the jacket black with the prisoner jacket.
Yeah.
I think that was the first time I ever saw Gallagher, ever. Hacienda, end of 88, and I was in the Hacienda, and I saw you and I went, that's a kid in spiral carpets, and you were with this mop top, and it was Noel. And I remember looking at him, oh my God, I just thought, it looks good, but I didn't go past it. You know? I mean, I didn't know that I'd end up working with him, do you know what I mean? You know?
Yeah. And when did you meet Noel then? What were your first memories of meeting him? I mean, we've got the famous story of King Tut's, which I'd like you to tell.
I actually met him before that by a complete fluke, because he was going out with this girl that used to work for me called Hannah.
Yeah.
That ended up, I think she married Juan Atkins, and she had a kid with Juan Atkins. But I might have got the wrong techno DJ. Right. It might be Derek May. I really don't know. You know, I apologise, Hannah, if I got the husband completely wrong. Right? But he was one of these guys, one of these techno DJs, and I'm not that any techno, so I don't really know the scene. And me and Debbie had just done House of Love. I think you were on the bill. And when Spirals, did you do House of Love and did Spirals play?
Yeah, we did Reading. In fact, right, okay. Yeah, we headlined it. We headlined it, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. You were at the gig. And me and Debbie was hanging out with me and we walked. We went to walk out of the enclosure bit and Hannah goes, McGee. And I went, all right, Hannah. And she goes, meet Noel. And that was the very first time I ever met him.
Right, yeah.
And all it was all right. And that's when we never spoke. But that was the very first time I ever met a guy.
Right. So your time in Manchester, obviously, you met Noel, and then the big moment at King Tut's. Talk us through that, because we've heard the well-documented version of it. Sister Lovers, Manchester band, were playing up there. Debbie's band, wasn't it?
Debbie's. It was Debbie's band, and I wasn't seeing that much here anymore. I was used to see it every weekend at the Height Acid House, because it was like my little buddy that we used to party with. But she'd got a band together with Louise, and they were going to play up in... I worked it out, because there was another Sister Lovers band, right? And the Sister Lovers band was Joe Foster managed that band. Okay. So I phoned Foster up and I went, are you playing King Tut's next weekend? He went, no. I went, oh, it must be Debbie. I thought, if I go up to the Sub Club on the Friday night or the Saturday night, have a good night, and then I'll nick into that and then go back. But still, even on the day, I think I went up to the Sub Club. Can't even really remember what I'd done, but I think I went to the Sub Club on the Saturday night, got up to Nonsense and all that stuff. And I think I thought about 6 o'clock at night, well, I'd go down. Best decision ever made, Clint, right? Yeah. You know, ever. Right? Yeah. And it was like, do I go down or I'll go with the gig? I'll go and annoy her and I'll be fun, right? You know, and I had two bands on. Wander on in, 8:30 at night, City of Culture, Glasgow City of Culture. The pubs are open 21 hours, right? and I'll walk on in and in Man City Blue with Adidas. The main man, he's sitting there, Liam Gallagher. Yeah. And I was like, I didn't know it was Liam Gallagher, obviously, at this time, but I just thought, Manx in the area, he's got to be the drug dealer. That's kind of secretly thought. I thought, but he's too good looking to be in a band. and then it was all, they were sort of posturing that they would beat up the security kind of guy, because there was about 10 or 11 of them, right? There was about two wee Glasgow security guys. And I was looking at them and I just thought, Bonehead, I looked at Bonehead and I thought, he's got to be the singer. Do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? You know, because he's going bald. Makes total sense. He's the singer. That'll be the drug dealer. And wander upstairs when they finally, Debbie had said, oh, we'll have a set. Let them play four songs. And wandered on upstairs. And they just coming on. And I think it was they started with Rock and Roll Star. And then they went into, which was just phenomenal. And then they went Up in the Sky, Bring It On Down. and then they done I Am the Walrus. And do you remember back in the day, because you were big around that time, 93.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember the time that when bands like that covered Beatles songs, it was always horrible? Well, and I just thought, well, it's going to be rubbish. Here we go. This is the point, you know, you prick the balloon and you don't get the deal, dude. Because in my head, I went, if this is good, I'm going to sign them. And it was amazing. And I went, I'm going to sign them.
Yeah.
I went up to Mark Coyle, who had got kicked off the Teenage Fan Club tour for doing drugs with me. Right?
He got kicked out of the Inspirals camp at the same time as Noel, actually. So that sort of thing. But we remain friends.
No, the manager, Chaz Banks, he's another mank.
Yeah.
And the Teenage Fan Club went, you keep giving Alan drugs and getting him off his tits, you're out. So he's like, you know, I mean, he couldn't get rid of me, Chaz, but he got rid of Coyley.
Yeah.
So I went up to Coyley and went, who's the manager? They didn't even have a manager. And I went, no, I'll take you to the main guy. He's called Noel. I went up and saw Noel and I went, I want to sign you. And he went, who are you? And I went, Alan McGee, Creation Records. And he went, right, we're up for that. I went, all right. And that was the beginning of the whole thing.
What was it that grabbed you about the band?
I think it sounds a bit mad because he's not known as this, but the great guitar player and great songs. Liam was quiet that gig.
Oh, he was quiet before that. Before you signed him, he was one of the quietest lads in Manchester.
Yeah.
He was always the best looking, but he's meek. I'm a big fan.
Well, yeah, you very do quiet. Because you were really there. I mean, he was standing and he was not projecting.
Mm.
And Noel always told me after that, oh, he just went through into a dip, McGee.
Yeah.
You know, he used to be like that. So I don't know if that's true or it's not true.
It's true. Because I remember the week that you signed up, his big news round here, was the week that Liam, as we now know him, was born. You know what I mean? The character and the skill was there before, but it was almost like he put on a new tracksuit after you signed him. And that was when it became the loud, brash, in your face, I don't fuck with anybody. That's when Liam, as we know him, was born, the week you signed him. I mean that literally. Is it something as well about the fact that all these bands that we've talked about so far, the Primals do it, Mary Chain did it, My Bloody Valentine, the kind of bands that just act like they don't give a fuck what anybody thinks?
Yeah.
Is that what appeals to you? Rebelliousness?
It is something like that. I agree with that. But I think it's got to be great songs, dude. It's great records. I mean, I'm still turned on by music.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm like, music's the big deal to me, Clint. Yeah, do you know what I mean? I've only ever been good at one thing, and that's music.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, everybody goes, oh, you're really good at business. I'm all right at business, but I'm brilliant at music.
You did a bit of art dealing, didn't you? Or collecting? Yeah, Do you collect art still?
Yeah. I mean, back in the day, you know what I mean? You know, I did do all that. But the truth is, I'm really only good at one thing, and that's music.
Music.
But it still is in me, and I've still got to do it. And I'm still driven, you know what I mean?
So within a couple of years, getting Oasis, literally within a couple of years, they were an household name. They're on the front of every tabloid.
Yeah.
And then that hurricane of chaos and colour and energy and fucking craziness.
Yeah.
What was it like in your position? Like, we were all looking at it on the tabloids and the telly thinking, this is brilliant. You know what I mean? But you must have had equal parts, this is brilliant, and equal parts, this is going to kill me. What was it like in the middle of that hurricane?
I got out of the party thing of that. I mean, from I met them May 93, and I got sober February 94, and then after that I had to watch the whole thing for the side. I had to watch, you know, I couldn't go and do the drink the drugs thing, which was actually my saving grace. It's why I've managed to keep the band.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Have you been sober since then, or did you get back on?
I got relapsed once about 2002 2003, for a couple of years, but not with drugs, but booze. Yeah. And then I stopped again. Yeah. It's not, I, you know what I mean, it's just not for me. I mean, if you can handle it, good luck. Do you know what I mean? Get on there. It's not as if I'm like, I don't go to the NA thing or anything like that. It's just not for me, you know, the booze. I mean, I just want to keep my dignity, dude. Do you know what I mean? You get old and you're just like, can I just be slightly dignified? Do you know what I mean? You know?
So that must have been harder still then, if you were sober and everybody else is partying, or did it make it easier?
It made it easier in a bizarre way. You know what I mean? Because, you know, once you take yourself off the football pitch, nobody's expecting you to go and score a hat trick. So it's a bit like, if I'd been on drugs, there's no way I would have kept Oasis. They'd have dumped me for the second album. Do you know what I mean? You know, because they knew it was like, it was on for being the biggest band in the world. You can't have the guy that runs a record company being a Jakey.
Yeah.
So luckily I wasn't a Jakey anymore. I was like, oh, I was a Jakey for the last 10 years, but I had got sober and I was like, I was me. I was like sober, Alan, and it was all right.
You nearly got into politics at one point, didn't you, when you were swanning about Downing Street and that?
Yeah. I did my little bit. I mean, I got the... New Deal for Musicians through.
That's massive news at the time. That was absolutely
that's
massive.
I mean, I think that was, you know, that was payback for other people that had ever supported me. You know, I mean, like, all right, I'll get the government to pay for your benefits and you can go and be musicians.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, but for a certain demographic of people, you know, for like people about 35, they love me for that. Or maybe not 35, 40. But, you know, they were on it, you know.
Yeah. Fast forward a few years after that, you stepped out of the music industry for a little while, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I've got a wee daughter who's 18 now.
Yeah, Charlie.
But and I was bringing her up, and I got to about 8, and I'd been spending a load of time in America working with Joaquin Phoenix and stuff like that, and I just decided, you know, I'm missing my daughter. Do you know what I mean? You know, I don't have that thing, and we're really tight now because I took her to school for 5 years.
Yeah.
And it got to about 13. And you, I know you've got kids, so you probably got it yourself. Yeah. It got to about 13, and went like, don't come in, Dad.
Yeah, they do that, yeah.
We have
you're a
not
bit
cool.
Of that, yeah. We have a little bit of that.
Yeah.
What about management? So recently you got back into management, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what made you, after, with all the knowledge and experience that you've had of babysitting these grown-ups that are often confused and slightly insane characters, you know,
what
crazy.
Happened was that I moved back to London and I wrote a book, which is the film that's coming out with Irvine Welsh and Danny Boyle doing, and I got a phone call for the Mary Chain. Do you want to come back and manage us? And then I got one for Wilco Johnson. I've always known Sean forever. Do you know what I mean? And it ended up that, you know, they ended up not having a manager, and like they went like, do you want to work with us? You know? So I just ended up falling in with a lot of people that I've kind of known forever. Yeah. I knew Wilco back in the day, you know.
Wilco,
I mean?
Johnson. We're talking Wilco Johnson, Dr. Feelgood. And also, I mean, other beautiful people. You're doing Cast, Las Vegas, Blue Tones.
I love John Power.
Some of the most beautiful people that I've ever met are there, right
James
on your
Allen.
List.
Yeah,
James
Allen, you know,
a close
all.
Friend
yeah,
of
yeah,
mine, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it easy work these days, or is it?
It is what it is. I mean, I mean, there's a lot on. I mean, I've got the little label, Creation 23, which is, like, I'm finding some great new stuff, because the majors aren't interested in signing the indie rock and roll bands, and there's some good stuff. So I'm putting them out, Clint. I've got the management, like we talked about. You know, I've got the film. Spud's playing me.
Really?
Incredible. Irvine Welsh got Spud. And then I've got this spoken word tour that you can help me do that. Right? That's fantastic.
I'll come and do a bit of that with you.
I tell you how the film happened. It was like I'd done the book and I moved to London, and Irvine loved that book. And I was going, I don't even think it's that good. And he went, no, it's amazing, Mickey. Let me make a film about it. Mm. So it went like that for 3 years, going on 4 years. And he was always short a little bit of money. He got a production company involved in it, but he was always short $500,000, $1 million. It was all that. And I just never thought it was going to happen. And he went, I'm going to get Danny Boyle. And I went, really? Within 6 days, we had 3 offers to fund the whole film.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's just Danny Boyle, just bringing Danny Boyle on board.
Yeah, gives it all new kudos, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about home life, health at the moment. We've got, obviously, dead straight these days. You're living in Wales. Are you still living on a farm?
Yeah. It's, I take the piss that it's a farm. It's just a big house with loads of land.
Have you got any animals on there?
Yeah, my missus is crazy. She's got 3 horses and 2 dogs. And I'm not an animal person at all. Right. Loads of cats, you know what I mean? But, you know, my daughter and my wife, you know, they love animals. So what do? You just got to go along with it, haven't you?
We've got loads of pets, and it's like, it's not me that's collecting them. It's mainly our 8-year-old Cass here. So it's like, he loves animals. But it's me that has to do all the mucking out and feeding them and taking them to the vets and all that. Some of the things you find yourself doing, and like, we've got a guinea pig that's had a big rash across its backside for the last couple of weeks, and we've been treating that. And I'm sat there looking at its arse in the morning, 10 o'clock, thinking, I wonder if Paul Weller has to do this kind of shit.
I ran into Weller the other week.
Oh yeah, he's doing all right now.
Yeah, he's producing some band called The Touts. Have you heard them?
I've not heard The Touts.
A good band. Right. And he was down, and I was talking. I hadn't seen him for years.
Yeah.
Maybe 5, 6, 7 years. It was great. But he looks amazing.
I get to see him every year now. Usually when he drops an album, I get to chat to him again for the show. But he's doing great. He's a lovely bloke. Very inspirational.
There was one funny bit, because he didn't recognise me when he was like, I'm like, it's McGee. He went, all right, okay. And then I went, you're looking great. And like, that's just a Scottish thing. You're looking great, right?
Yeah.
And he looked at me as if, I'm Paul Weller. What do you mean? Of course I look great. He didn't say that. And he went, I've been sober 11 years now. I went, all right, good.
Yeah, he's doing well with it as well. Let's talk about Manchester again, Alan. So what is it about how would you identify the spirit of the city? How would you describe it?
You know what, Clint? It's like, I didn't have much success up to Oasis in Manchester. And since then, I've done well in Manchester. had a few goes at it. Had Bodines. Yeah. Never really happened. Good band.
Very, very influential on the Spirals. You know, they were one of the first established bands that helped us along. They took us on tour and they were brilliant. Very, very
good band.
Yeah.
Really Bunnymen. I had Hypnotone.
Yeah.
Good band. Never really happened. But I had about three from Manchester.
Yeah.
And none of them happened. And I was like, I thought it was an unlucky city for me. And then I ran into Oasis. And then it was my city.
Yeah.
And now when I come up here, there is, I mean, I got a lot of love, you know, up here. People like me a lot, you know, and it's like, it's really touching, you know. I love Manchester. But when I was coming here, I was like, I feel more at home. This sounds mad, but I feel more at home in Manchester than I do in Glasgow these days. Do you know what I mean? You know, I mean, London, I'm nearly there the whole time now, you know, doing my business. And I love London and everything. What I kind of like about Manchester, it's just not the inflated prices that London is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, London's just, it's just too expensive. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It kind of rubs me up the wrong way because it's too expensive. Well, Manchester, you get here and it's just right. I like that.
Yeah. Do you think a band like Oasis could have come from a place like, say, Mablethorpe on the East Coast?
No, no way. You know that. Come on. You know that, you know.
It can only come out of a city. It can only come out of a city.
It can only come from Manchester, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. I think Glasgow has its moments as well. You know, very similar.
I'll tell you why Manchester's amazing. You all think that it's the greatest city in the world. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But because you all believe it, something always happens here. And that's why Manchester's cool.
It's true. And it's a real self-belief. It's not just an arrogance. I think part of it probably is arrogance.
You've had the bands, New Order, Oasis, you know, Stone Roses. I mean, you've had some amazing bands.
Yeah. Let's talk about your favourite Humans of Manchester ever. Right. Give us three or four, five, six names of people that are your iconic Mancunians or people that have had a great effect on
Tony
the city.
Tony Wilson has to be, because I was going to chuck it in at one point. I was gutted. I was a wee guy. I was about 24, 25, and I owed about 100 grand to Rough Trade. They were threatening to sue me. And Tony just went, oh, you're doing it wrong. And I went, well, what am I doing wrong? And he went, you give your bands to the Body Majors, you build them up, and then you take the House of Love. I'm still mates with Guy, by the way, right? And you know, you sell them for like 400 grand to the major. Okay, you might make your 80 grand management commission. Great, McGee. But at the end of the day, you know, you're just, that band is a big band and you gave it away.
Yeah.
And I was like, right. And I had that talk. When it came up to My Bloody Valentine and Primal Scream, they stayed because I said, no, you're not going. Let's do this thing. Less money in the beginning, more money at the end. And it's happened for them, you know.
So Anthony Wilson's on your list of humans of Manchester. Give us a couple of others.
All right, well, it has to be Sean Ryder. The man that turned creation onto Acid House. You know what I mean? You know, but one of the best Sean Ryder story I've ever seen. It was I just got into the whole Hacienda Friday night at Hacienda. What was that called? Was it called the Wet Club or something?
There's one called Nude.
That's it. Nude? You got it. Right. It was Nude.
Yeah.
And on a Friday night, and I walked in with my pal, and the whole place was kicking off. It was just going off, right? Just people on the dance floor going like they're just having it. And I looked on stage. And it's Sean was in a gold lammy shirt that I'm told by Muzzer was Muzzer's shirt, right? Muzzer's mum's shirt, Sean. And he was just leading the charge on stage, 600 people. And it was like tribal. And I thought, I love you. You know what I mean? You know, so, you know, have to be Sean. Bez, because it's just like, he's like, he reminds me of Joe Strummer.
He's got a very similar spirit.
Yeah. And I've seen him in dressing rooms before. When little kids are like, I have to go now. And he goes, no, just stay, have another drink.
Mm.
No. And then the kid goes, I've got to go get the last train. And Bez goes, how much is the taxi? The wee kid goes, I think it was in Folkestone, I saw this, 50 quid. And Bez pulls out a 50 quid note, gives the guy the taxi money. Nobody does that. You know.
It's
you,
unique.
You're hanging
it's
out
unique.
With all these guys.
Yeah.
You know, no, none of them do that. You know what I mean? So that he's a one-off.
Yeah.
Hookie, I love Hookie. I was going to say collectively New Order because I love that band, but I love Hookie. He's the first time we ever met him, it was the Jesus and Mary Chain on stage at the Hacienda, and Hookie was growling at us the entire gig. We were trying to get on, he wasn't growling at us. And then we became pals with him later on, and I went, do you remember growling at us the entire gig? And he went, yeah, I wanted to beat you up. You know?
He didn't like it.
Because we thought you were taking the piss. And I went, no, that was the band. That's what the band were like.
We've probably got to have every member of Oasis as well, haven't we?
Yeah, and another one, good guy. He was the first person to ever rent me a flat. Erasmus.
Oh, Alan, yeah. He's still with us, isn't he?
Yeah, I saw him at a funeral recently, you know.
Right.
Good guy.
What about Debbie? Let's get Debbie in there. All right. Without Debbie, there wouldn't have been...
No, she was inspirational, man. Yeah. It's like, you know, she's a queen acid house. But I've had the best times ever with her, man, you know what I mean? And she's still doing music. She still takes photographs. She's still, you know, she still sends me music. Do you know what I mean?
You know, I'm actually cutting a ribbon for her.
Are you?
A week on Saturday. She's opening a photographic studio in Stockport.
All right.
They want me to be the local celeb to come and cut the ribbon. So I'm doing that. Before I ask you the last question, Oasis stroke the Gallaghers, do you think there'll be a reunion? Even if it's just the brothers becoming friends again?
You'd have to think that might happen one time, because life never runs smooth. Do you know what I mean? And through fate, they'll be thrown together at some point. I mean, whether they'll ever be in a band with each other again, I don't know. I can't call that. I know there's a lot of hurt feelings both sides. Well, we know anyway. I know there is. But they're not going to get together anytime soon, dude. You know, but you know, the only thing that might happen is that circumstances might change in people's lives.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to go saying what I think that might be, you know, because it could be anything, you know what I mean?
Totally, yeah.
You know, it could be bad news.
Yeah,
in
it could
some
be
ways,
tragic,
you know?
Yeah.
And they're thrown together, and suddenly, you know, it looks like, I don't hate you, blah, blah, blah. But at the moment, you know, I can't see it anytime soon. What do you think?
I think, and everybody I speak to, particularly that knows them, but a lot of the fans as well, I'd like to see them back together as brothers.
While
Peggy's still around.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that'd be the most beautiful ending to the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we get a band after that, brilliant, but that don't matter. I think the brotherhood is the main thing that we'd like to see back, really.
I agree.
Yeah, let's see what we can do. Bang their heads together, Mr. McGee.
I never see Liam.
Right.
I never run into him. I haven't seen Liam for about 4 years. I DJ'd for him in Japan. That was the last time I saw him.
Yeah.
And I walked in and there was a dressing room about the size of your building. And he was all right. thanks for coming. All right. And I DJ'd for him that time. That's about 2014 or 15 in Japan.
Yeah.
A couple of shows. And then, but I see Noel. I haven't seen him for about a year, but I saw him at the side of the stage with Gorillaz. He was with his wee boy Donovan, you know what I mean? And I was putting Sean on stage, so it was like kind of one of them. Do you know what I mean?
Right, last question. Alan, describe Manchester in 3 words.
Homer Wilson.
Fantastic. Alan McGee, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you.
That was Alan McGee. Next week, I'm joined by Mr. Rock and Roll star himself, my old mate Liam Gallagher. He'll be joining me for a very special episode of Humans of Excess Manchester. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us. Feel free to leave us a review. We always like to hear your feedback. Thanks to our friends at Safer Roads GM for sponsoring this series, and thank you for listening. See you next week.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.